This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 77 to 78 of chapter Al-Hajj from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون وجاهدوا في الله حق جهاده هو اجتباكم وما جعل عليكم في الدين من حرج ملة أبيكم إبراهيم وَسَمَّاكُمُ الْمُسْلِمِينَ مِنْ قَبْلُ وَفِي هَذَا لِيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ شَهِيدًا عَلَيْكُمْ وَتَكُونُوا شُهَدَاءَ عَلَى النَّاسِ وَسَمَّاكُمُ الْمُسْلِمِينَ مِنْ قَبْلُ وَفِي هَذَا لِيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ شَهِيدًا عَلَيْكُمْ وتكونوا شهداء على الناس فأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة واعتصموا بالله هو مولاكم فنعم المولى ونعم النصير صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. O you who believe, bow down and prostrate yourselves and serve your Lord and do good that you may succeed.
and strive hard in the way of Allah, such striving as is due to Him. He has chosen you and has not laid upon you any hardship in religion. The faith of your father Ibrahim, he named you Muslims before, and in this, that the apostle may be a bearer of witness to you, and you may be bearers of witness to the people. Therefore, keep up prayer and pay the poor rate, and hold fast by Allah. He is your guardian. How excellent the guardian, and how excellent the helper.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says the US must rely on diplomacy instead of pressure and intimidation if it really wants to help revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Israel launches a fresh missile attack on Syria's capital, Damascus. The Syrian military says air defenses shot down most of the Israeli missiles. Britain is preparing its military to drive ambulances ahead of industrial action by more than 10,000 paramedics and call handlers on Wednesday. That's also in the headlines. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Iran is calling on the US to choose diplomacy over pressure, intimidation, and confrontation if it really wants the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Iran's permanent ambassador to the UN says the US must show real political will and agree to completely fulfill its obligations under the agreement. Emir Saeed Iravani emphasized Iran's commitment to dialogue and diplomacy. He said Iran is ready to resume the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA or the removal of sanctions, unilateral US sanctions against Iran, and even arrange a ministerial meeting as soon as possible to declare its restoration. The Iranian officials stressed that the current standoff is a direct result of the US unilateral withdrawal from the deal in 2018. Iran's foreign minister has said that a summit taking place this week in Jordan will be a good opportunity to complete the JCPOA revival negotiations. The third edition of the Tehran Dialogue Forum has kicked off in the Iranian capital. The main objective of this year's event is to promote regional cooperation, particularly in the Persian Gulf region. Addressing the forum, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, said Tehran seeks to enhance cooperation with all its neighbors, including Persian Gulf countries, to establish lasting security in the region. Gisu Misha Ahmadi tells us more.
About 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries are in Tehran to attend the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022. The initiative, dubbed Neighborhood Policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is the third of its kind, and this time it focuses on regional friendship and trust building.
The main message of this forum is boosting regional cooperation and dialogue. We always welcome dialogue, particularly when it comes to finding solutions to the challenges that we face.
The keynote speakers of the forum, former Iranian Foreign Minister Kamal Kharrazi, the former Prime Minister of Iraq Adel Abdel Mahdi, the Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Denis Ronaldo Moncada, and other participants reiterated the same stance, giving Iran credit for the initiative.
This is important in order to strengthen your policy in the regional dimension due to the new dimension the whole world and new world order that is much more focused on regionalism then as on the wide international arena.
Pakistan and Iran are the only two countries that are always directly affected by Afghanistan. So I think the Tehran Dialogue Forum is very important in that regard, that there has to be regional dialogue. And Iran being at the forefront of this is a welcoming development. And I think, look, it's important for the region to take ownership. And we see Iran doing that through this forum. And I think it's important, again, to discuss through dialogue to move forward towards any cooperation.
The message of the forum, however, is not limited to regional countries.
We can only really build peace if we do it through dialogue and with the diversity of participation. So I think we are grateful for the invitation to Venezuela, and we think it's important to address this. Even though we're not from the region of Iran, we also think in regional terms. Venezuela is part of Latin America and the Caribbean. We are a zone of peace, as we decreed it in 2014. And we think that it is important for the different regions of the world to establish communication and see how we can really face common challenges.
The first and second rounds of the Tehran Dialogue Forum were held in 2019 and 2020. And as always, addressing the latest developments in West Asia will be on top of the agenda.
The discussions of the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022 will continue in four different panels, focusing on regional security, energy security, the Ukraine crisis, and the prospects of peace in Afghanistan. Yusumi Shah Ahmadi, Tehran.
Now turning to Iraq, where a gunman has killed 8 civilians and injured 7 others in the northern province of Diyala. Iraqi officials say the death toll might increase, as some of the wounded are in critical condition. The attack happened in the town of Khalis. There has been no claim of responsibility. However, police have blamed Daesh terrorists for the attack. The assault comes a day after a roadside bomb killed at least 9 federal policemen near the northern oil city of Kirkuk. Daesh claimed that attack. The Takfiri group launched its offensive in Iraq in 2014 and controlled roughly a third of the country at its height. The Iraqi army defeated the terrorist group 3 years later with the help of popular resistance groups, but some Daesh remnants and sleeper cells are still present in areas across the country. The Israeli regime has launched a missile attack on the Syrian capital, Damascus, in a new act of aggression against the Arab country. Military sources say Syrian air defenses shot down most of the Israeli missiles. The sources added that the attack resulted in the injury of 2 soldiers but caused no loss of life. The missiles were fired from the northeast of Lake Tiberias in the occupied territories in the early hours of Tuesday. Israel has frequently launches missile attacks on Syria, and Damascus has repeatedly complained to the UN over the Israeli violation of its sovereignty and territorial integrity, urging the Security Council to take action. The calls have, however, fallen on deaf ears. Medical negligence in Israeli jails has taken the life of another Palestinian inmate. Our correspondent Muna Kandil says the victim was suffering from serious health conditions before he lost his life.
We are speaking about Nasser Ahmed, this Palestinian prisoner and the leader of the Fatah's Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Ramallah. He was arrested by the Israeli forces in 2010, and he received 5 life sentences behind bars, plus 50 years as well. He was arrested by the Israeli forces several times before 2002. The Israelis had accused Nasser Abu Ahmed of killing a number of Israeli soldiers during the incursions that taken place in Ramallah. What happened is that Nasser Abu Ahmed was diagnosed as a cancer-stricken prisoner, and the Israeli prison authorities had refused to release him upon calls by the by his family and his mother, as well as by the Palestinian Authority and the different resistance groups. Instead, and according to doctors, the result of the tumor in his head was a direct result that the Israeli jailers or the Israeli authorities were not giving Nasser Abu Hamed the appropriate medication.
North Korea has dismissed efforts by neighboring South to impose more sanctions on the country. Pyongyang says it's not afraid of such bans and they won't stop its missile program. Kim Yo-jong, the sister of the North Korean leader, says Pyongyang has no reason for fear with its right to survival and development under threat. Her remarks come days after Pyongyang launched two mid-range ballistic missiles. North Korea says the launches are an important test for the development of a spy satellite, stressing that such an initiative is a pressing priority directly linked to the country's security. Meanwhile, North Korea denounced Japan's new security strategy as a, quote, new aggression policy and vowed to take practical measures against it. This days after Japan unveiled its biggest military buildup since World War II amid tensions in the region and beyond. Frank Smith is our correspondent in the South Korean capital, Seoul, and joins us now. Frank, before I start with you, we've got breaking news reaching us here that the United States has deployed B-52 bombers and F-52 fighters warplanes for joint drills with South Korea on Tuesday, according to the News One agency. So instead of seeking to ease tensions in the region, it looks like the United States is looking to increase tensions.
That's right. This follows South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's determination to bring more so-called strategic assets. Those are American weapons that can potentially deliver nuclear weapons. This also comes with a stronger commitment to so-called extended deterrence. That's the U.S. nuclear umbrella, in which the U.S. promises essentially to use any weapons at its disposal, including nuclear weapons, to defend its allies around the world, and in this case, South Korea and Japan.
Right. So, you know, Frank, many would be asking at this point, why is the U.S. allowed to pass a bill to the tune of $858 billion on its military spending while preventing North Korea from protecting its sovereignty and territorial integrity?
Well, there is a lot of hypocrisy here on the Korean Peninsula in terms of relations and the international community's position on North Korea. You need look no further than the United Nations Security Council that imposes a series of sanctions on North Korea and has done for more than a decade now, seeking to inhibit North Korea's ability to trade on the international stage like a normal country. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's sister, Kim Yo-jong, also suggested that the sanctions really weren't effective in terms of restraining North Korea's missile or nuclear programs, and that seems to be the case. If you talk to analysts here in South Korea and abroad, they'll tell you that it's really unlikely that North Korea is going to give up its nuclear and missile programs, and that what's really needed is some type of negotiations, even incentives toward North Korea to bring them to the negotiating table. Unfortunately, what we really have here is an arms race now developing, with North Korea spending more money on weapons, generally U.S. weapons. Japan just announcing that it's going to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP, including developing counter-strike capabilities to respond to what it perceives as a North Korean threat.
So essentially, Frank, a very defiant tone from Kim Yo-jong, the North Korean leader's sister. In essence, that means, in what she's referring to in our news report, that no matter what happens, and as you alluded to, the sanctions or pressure, military pressure, the U.S. sending bombers, warplanes, the war drills with South Korea and Japan, is not going to prevent South Korea, sorry, it's not going to prevent North Korea from advancing its weapons and development of its strategic weapons.
No, I don't believe it is, and that's really the consensus of experts that you find on both sides of the aisle. There is the, I think, delusion, a lot of people would say delusion of the South Korean government, that it can pressure North Korea into giving up its nuclear weapons and missiles, and that it can get some upper hand if and when negotiations take place. The U.S. really is kind of free riding on South Korea's policy toward North Korea in this manner. But, you know, given that most of North Korea's trade, 90% of its trade has traditionally been with China over the last couple of decades, so implementing those sanctions from the UN Security Council that's generally split between one side, the U.S. and its allies, and China and Russia supporting North Korea, it's unlikely we're going to see, you know, real increased measures from the UN Security Council, or measures that will try to find some way to get to negotiations and pressure the U.S. to come to some type of talks with North Korea.
Thanks a lot, Frank Smith there, our correspondent, joining us live from the South Korean capital, Seoul. Moving on, Britain is arranging for its military to replace striking ambulance drivers as walkouts enter a potentially more dangerous phase in the country. Authorities have failed to reach an agreement with over 10,000 healthcare workers over pay. The country's ambulance drivers, call handlers, and support staff will walk out on Wednesday as the country's economy slides into recession. People in Britain are grappling with soaring inflation and rising consumer prices. The increasing cost of food and energy has caused anger among workers in various public and private sectors, pushing them to stage walkouts. EU member states, meanwhile, have finally reached a deal on setting a price cap on natural gas in a bid to tackle the energy crunch triggered by the war in Ukraine. A spokesperson for the Czech Republic, which holds the rotating presidency of the bloc, said the energy ministers have finalized the price limit of 180 euros per megawatt hour. The deal follows weeks of talks on the emergency measure that had split opinions across the 27-nation bloc. It includes a package of measures to help the members protect their citizens and businesses from extreme price and volatility and prepare for the next winter. The Polish Prime Minister says the new compromise will put an end to what he called the Russian manipulation of the market. Moscow, however, has described the move as, quote, unacceptable, saying the cap is an attack on market pricing. The price cap will come into effect on February 15th. Now that brings an end to our international bulletin for this hour.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the best of the names, In the Name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
In the limelight. California Congressman Adam Schiff said on Sunday, 18th of December, that he believes there is sufficient evidence to criminally charge former President Donald Trump in relation to his efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. California Congressman Adam Schiff said on Sunday that he believes there is sufficient evidence to criminally charge former President Donald Trump in relation to his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Adam Schiff's dramatic statement on CNN's State of the Union program came just one day before the House January 6 Select Committee, to which he belongs, is poised to release an outline of its extensive investigative report on the U.S. Capitol attack, which has been linked to 9 deaths, including the suicides of traumatized law enforcement officers. The committee is expected to use its last meeting on Monday to refer Donald Trump as well as others to the U.S. Justice Department in relation to the former president's attempts to reverse his 2020 defeat to Joe Biden. During this final meeting, the House panel is expected to outline an executive summary of its findings, propose legislative recommendations, vote to adopt the report, and then vote on possible criminal and civil referrals. Adam Schiff is one of 9 members, 7 of whom are Democrats like him, serving on the January 6th committee. The potential referrals involving Donald Trump are expected to involve obstruction of an official congressional proceeding, as well as conspiracy to defraud the United States. The Guardian first reported the nature of these referrals. Adam Schiff told CNN host Jake Tapper that he can't comment on specifics of any possible referrals. The predicted criminal referrals are effectively symbolic because Congress can't force prosecutors to pursue charges. I think that the evidence is there that Donald Trump committed criminal offenses in connection with his efforts to overturn the election, said Adam Schiff, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee. Adam Schiff added, "And viewing it as a former prosecutor, I think there's sufficient evidence to charge the former president." CNN host Jake Tapper asked Adam Schiff whether this was enough to secure a conviction. "Well, I don't know what the Justice Department has. I do know what's in the public record. The evidence seems pretty plain to me, but I would want to see the full body of evidence if I were in the prosecutor's shoes to make decision," Adam Schiff responded. "But this is someone who in multiple ways tried to pressure state officials to find votes that didn't exist. This is someone who tried to interfere with a joint session of the Congress, even inciting a mob to attack the Capitol. If that's not criminal, then I don't know what it is." Asked whether he thought Donald Trump would face criminal charges, Adam Schiff said, "The short answer is, I don't know. I think that he should face criminal charges. I think he should face the same remedy, force of law, that anyone else would." Adam Schiff said he was worried, however, that it may take until he is no longer politically relevant for justice to be served. "That's not the way it should be in this country, but there seems to be an added evidentiary burden with someone who has a large enough following. That simply should not be the case, but I find it hard otherwise to explain why, almost 2 years from the events of 6th of January 2021, and with the evidence that's already in the public domain, why the Justice Department hasn't moved more quickly than it has," Adam Schiff said. The Guardian previously reported that Trump allies who might face criminal referrals include former high-ranking White House staffers. The panel is also expected to make civil referrals to the House Ethics Committee involving Republican Congress members, as well as suggest disbarment of some of Donald Trump's attorneys. The January 6th committee has largely concluded that the insurrection was rooted in a conspiracy, sources previously told Guardian. The panel, the House panel, found that Donald Trump oversaw a political plan for his vice president, Mike Pence, to refuse to certify election results in a joint session of Congress on 6th of January 2021, as well as a coup plot to force Congress's hand if he refused. Committee investigators think that Donald Trump's alleged desire to illegally thwart the certification of the election he lost was obvious months before 6th of January 2021. They believe it extended from the time he agreed with a fake electoral plot so states would swap Biden's Electoral College votes for him until he refused for hours to call off Capitol attackers. Donald Trump did not leave documentary evidence of his alleged involvement, but his staffers left a paper trail. During Trump's presidency, he used his power to stifle inquiries the House Committee is expected to say. NBC News has also covered the same story. Representative Adam Schiff, a Democrat from California, said on Sunday that the House January 6th committee has evidence that former President Donald Trump broke the law, but he declined to get specific about the criminal referrals it could make ahead of the House panel's final meeting on Monday. In an interview on CNN's State of the Union program, Adam Schiff, a member of the committee, cited multiple efforts by Donald Trump to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election, including pressuring state officials to go along with his false claims of widespread election fraud. "If that's not criminal, then I don't know what is," he said. Adam Schiff, however, declined to comment on the possible referrals the committee could make, saying the panel is set to vote on them and will reveal its decision on Monday, as well as release his final report this month. "But I can tell you that our process has been to look meticulously at the evidence and compare it to various statutes. If there is sufficient evidence as to each element of a particular crime," he said, "we are not referring, or at least won't be voting to refer anyone we think there may be evidence, because we want to focus on those for which we believe there's the strongest evidence." The committee, which has been forecasting the possibility of referring Donald Trump to the Justice Department for a crime, is actively considering charges of insurrection, obstruction of an official proceeding of Congress, and conspiracy. While all three charges are possible, the House panel has not yet made a final decision, three sources involved in the committee's deliberations said last week. "The potential recommendations are not necessarily reserved for Donald Trump, and they could also include referrals to other government agencies or to the House Ethics Committee." California Congressman Adam Schiff reiterated that he thinks Trump violated multiple criminal laws and should be prosecuted like any other American who breaks the law. Asked whether the House panel will refer members of Congress who ignored subpoenas from the panel to the Ethics Committee, Adam Schiff said its decision on the appropriate remedy for those lawmakers, who include Representatives Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, and Scott Perry, a Republican from Pennsylvania, will also be made public on Monday. "We have weighed what is the remedy for members of Congress. Is it a criminal referral to another branch of government, or is it better that Congress police its own?" he said, adding that the House panel has considered censure and ethics referrals.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sadarbat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Palestine, the Classified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The controversy over the recent remarks made by Kanye West and Kyrie Irving have shone a light on the Zionist movement's hostility towards the black community. In this week's show, we'll be examining the record of Zionist aggression against black and African American movements from the 1950s to the present day. I'll be talking to experts on this issue after this special report by Latifa Abu Chakra on the shameful history of the Zionist movement's attacks on black leaders and movements.
The active use of the tropes about black anti-Semitism by Zionist groups in relation to recent controversies has a history. We trace the evolution of the anti-Arab and specifically anti-black racism of the Zionist movement back to the 1960s and beyond. Attacks on prominent black celebrities and activists for their anti-Semitism are not new. They have a history. In fact, there have been attacks led by Zionist groups against practically all black leaders or prominent figures of note, from Marcus Garvey in the 1930s to today. His alleged antipathy to Jews was denounced, as were a whole host of black leaders inspired by Garvey through to the 1960s. One organization key to all of these attacks, but by no means the only one, is the Anti-Defamation League, created in 1913. The full panoply of black reformists and revolutionary leaders were denounced by the ADL as extremists and Jew-baiting. The Caribbean-born psychiatrist Frantz Fanon was denounced because of his alleged hatred of Jews and the imperialist state of Israel. They also denounced Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, Eldridge Cleaver, H. Rapp Brown, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Black Panther Party, Huey Newton, and Bobby Seale, and the singer Miriam Makeba. Right up to the present day, the ADL continues in denunciations of BLM. One key complaint was the black denunciations of Zionist manipulation of the anti-racist movement as far back as the 1960s were a mask for anti-Semitism. In fact, of course, Zionist penetration of the anti-racist movement has had the effect that some groups have a blind spot on Palestine. The denunciations have been accompanied by direct action. Since the 1930s, at least the Anti-Defamation League has spied on black critics of racism and have directly collaborated with the FBI and other organs of the state to attack them. In 1993, the San Francisco District Attorney investigated the ADL for collecting confidential information on nearly 10,000 activists and at least 700 organizations. The investigation showed that the ADL had directly surveilled and infiltrated social justice and human rights organizations. And its agents had received stolen police files from a surveillance program deemed illegal. The ADL even spied on anti-apartheid activists in the US and sold its intelligence to BOS, the intelligence agency of the South African apartheid regime, as well as providing information to Mossad. For the ADL, the black-led anti-racist movement is a bigger threat to Jewish interests than the far-right and white supremacists. When Zionists complain about black anti-Semitism, they're really complaining about uppity black people, especially those who are critical of Israel and Zionism.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's a co-founder and a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Jared Ball. Jared is a professor of communication and African studies at Morgan State University in Baltimore. He's also the author of The Myth and Propaganda of Black Buying Power, a second edition of which is due to be published early next year. Jared also hosts the podcast I Mix What I Like, and he's a co-founder of blackpowermedia.org. His decades of journalism, media, writing, and political work can be found at imixwhatilike.org. And we spoke to Jared earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you, though. I mean, tell us about Marcus Garvey and what the Anti-Defamation League, often referred to by its abbreviations, ADL, has to say about him.
Well, Garvey was a hero of the Jamaican nation. And in the film, there was a photograph of a monument to him, which is currently exists in Jamaica. But he was attacked by organizations like the ADL, including the ADL, back as far back as the 1930s. He died in 1940. He was regarded as being an anti-Semite, and of course they didn't pay any attention to his role in a kind of pan-Africanist consciousness, the raising of self-respect amongst black people in the US, and the arguments about what should happen in relation to racism. And of course that is emblematic of the way in which the ADL, and indeed other Zionist organizations in the US, targeted anyone who stood up for black civil rights or who argued against racism.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, well, we asked Jared what he made of our report on the ADL's activities in the black community.
Well, the ADL's activities are pretty consistent with their class and ideological or political positioning. And as part of representing the interests of the state, so to speak, they align themselves perfectly well with all of the state's suppressive elements.
David, of course, Frantz Fanon, wrote the seminal Wretched of the Earth and was active in the Algerian liberation movement, wasn't he? I mean, what was the ADL's gripe with him?
Well, it's one of the first instances, really, of the attempt to blur together anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. So they called him an anti-Semite, but what they were really condemning, and they say this explicitly, was his opposition to the imperialist state of Israel. It's a quote from one of their documents. So, you know, I mean, Fanon was, of course, involved with the FLN and the decolonization of Algeria. The Israelis, of course, as we know from previous shows, were involved on the other side and working with the settlers and with their death squads to target the liberation movement. So there's a very clear sense again here that this is about challenges to Israeli foreign policy interests, which of course is what the ADL was involved in from a very, very early age, you know, to actually pursue the foreign policy interests of the state of Israel, as opposed to pursuing what they were supposed to be pursuing, which is alleged anti-Semitism. Mm.
Well, we also asked Jared what the reaction to Malcolm X was from the white society in general, and specifically from the Zionist lobby.
White America was, and remains, I would argue, terrified of the actual Malcolm that existed, and which is why so much effort is ongoing to posthumously even rebrand him as somebody he wasn't, because his politics and his capabilities remain terrifying to those in power. So, the ADL and the Zionist efforts themselves part of a white supremacist, settler, colonialist, capitalist international apparatus targeted Malcolm just as the rest of that apparatus would, which was to, again, falsely define him, misinterpret him, rebrand and represent him in a way that stood against his actual politics and efforts, which of course involved all manner of what I and many others would consider greatness of socialism, pan-Africanism, anti-colonialism, among them.
David, there's a long list of black activists who've been spied on by the Anti-Defamation League. I mean, I wonder, are there any black groups that they didn't spy on?
Well, you, as you say, a very, very long list. I mean, practically everyone who you've ever heard of who has been a leader of a black anti-racist organization in the US has been spied upon.
Astonishing.
But the key question here is whether they thought that these organizations could be penetrated and mobilized towards their interests. Mm. So, for example, with Dr. King's organization, Martin Luther King's organization, they tried to work with that organization. They tried to penetrate that organization and make sure it wouldn't be critical of Israel. And they had some success with Dr. King.
Indeed.
In some respects on that. But they were still, his organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Organization, was spied upon by the ADL, as was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which is very close to Dr. King, back in the early 60s, moved away from it and especially split from it over the question of Palestine. So they wanted to penetrate those organizations, which they could do, to make sure they had a blind spot in Palestine. But they couldn't do that. They were denounced as anti-Semitic.
Jared then told us about the stance of Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam to the ADL.
Well, here I would think there's a little bit of a difference, because the politics of Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam differ greatly, particularly on some of the isms I just mentioned. Whereas the Nation of Islam, even elements of the Garvey movement aspired to some sort of level of black capitalism, which is decidedly apart and more centrist than the politics of Malcolm and many others to his left. They were still seen as threats to the establishment simply on the basis of their condemnation of the white supremacist nature of the state, of the treatment of black people, of the suppression of Islam and variations of black nationalism, which are and remain important to black liberation. But there is a difference and a nuance here in terms of how the ADL and other elements of the state look to suppress various elements, on the other hand, of the black community and its liberation movement.
Well, thanks for that. Let's just pause there for a moment. This report about how the Anti-Defamation League has been spying on black activists in recent times.
From spying on Desmond Tutu for the South African apartheid regime to smearing Mark Lamont Hill and Ilhan Omar, the Anti-Defamation League sure does get around. In fact, it was found that the KG organization had spied on at least 10,000 activists in 700 organizations across seven U.S. cities. At the same time it was spying on Desmond Tutu and selling the information to the apartheid regime, Israeli political figure Shimon Peres was attempting to arm minority white rule in South Africa with nuclear weapons. In 1968, the FBI began officially collaborating with the ADL, with the director of the government agency informing all branches to directly liaise with their regional leaders of the lobby group. This was, of course, simultaneous to the FBI's war against the black community known as COINTELPRO. Was the ADL involved in this shabby conspiracy too? This level of cooperation between the FBI and the ADL did not stop an internal memo by the agency in 1969 from questioning if the ADL worked for Israel. The now declassified document reads, "It is felt incredible to assume the information is not furnished to an official of the government of Israel. It is believed it very possibly represents a violation of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Despite that, today the ADL is the largest non-governmental trainer of law enforcement in the U.S. and is closer to the FBI than ever." Which brings us to the question of a key asset in the black community, the Reverend Al Sharpton. He has admitted spying on others for the FBI in the 1980s, describing his role as cooperating with an investigation by using electronic recording equipment in a briefcase to secretly record conversations with targets of interest. He's perhaps the ADL's strongest advocate in the African-American community, regularly appearing alongside ADL leader Jonathan Greenblatt to support his statements. Less known about Al Sharpton is that for many years his show on MSNBC has been produced by Moshe Arenstein, a former intelligence officer in the Israeli military. The black community in the United States is being targeted.
David, that's a really huge number of individuals and groups being spied on, isn't it? I mean, And all this was done with the connivance of the FBI.
The connivance of the FBI going back way back into the century, into the 1940s. There was a involvement there from the 1940s. The ADL tried itself to, first of all, to infiltrate the FBI, and that was rebuffed back in the 40s. But then they started to work very closely with them. And all the way through this period, they've worked closely with them. In the 60s, the files now show, there was some kind of questioning about what that, and we saw in the previous film, the whole question about the relationship with Israel, and the FBI said, well, of course, these people are giving this stuff to Mossad, but this is a bit dodgy, and it probably is against the law, but nevertheless, they continue to collaborate with them. It was only in the 1990s that the investigations first happened in San Francisco of some of the activities where these stats came out, the thousands of people, the hundreds of organizations which were spied upon. What's interesting about this is the way in which that relationship continues to this day. They advertise that they work together. And really what we should be seeing is a move away from the FBI and law enforcement working with the ADL, and more the ADL being monitored by the FBI, because they're clearly working on behalf of a hostile foreign government. There seems to be no recognition of that in law enforcement circles in the US, but there is in civil society.
Well, Jared then explained how the ADL's influential position at both YouTube and PayPal in vetting content and access to these services actually affects those platforms.
Well, I don't think the ADL has, from my vantage point at least, I don't think the ADL has any more of an undue negative influence than the platforms already in their commercial organization have from the outset. What the ADL does is play its role within that broader apparatus of pro-imperialist, pro-Zionist, pro-capitalist, white supremacist workings to limit discussion and narrow discussion to what is considered sanctionable or acceptable to those politics. So they fit right in is sort of the point that I'm getting at. Without the ADL's involvement, there would still be plenty of white supremacist and pro-capitalist and imperialist narrowing of discussion, whether it's through the advertising arrangement, whether it's through outright surveillance and suppression of radical politics, or the like. So here the ADL exists really to play the role among a certain class and ideology of Jews initially and Zionists more broadly to limit the discussion, even among the Jewish community, to make sure that radicalism doesn't go too far or get too much of a platform even among Jews. So that is clearly their tactic historically, and have used the anti-Semitic trope and the fear of the rise of a new black anti-Semitism for decades now to target, in this case, all forms of the black left, to make sure that whether it's on Twitter or historically in newspapers or magazines or elsewhere, that those politics remain equally narrow.
David, the ADL published a hair-raising paper back in 1992 entitled The Anti-Semitism of Black Demagogues and Extremists. I mean, who did they single out in that report?
Well, they didn't single out in the sense of a small number of people. They had a huge list of black politicians and indeed black cultural figures. So amongst the black cultural figures was Ice Cube, the rapper from N.W.A., also, of course, the rap group Public Enemy were singled out in this. You can see it on the screen there. The notion of a black demagogue, extraordinary, really that they could have got away with that. And this is a file which is publicly available and has been disclosed through FBI document, Freedom of Information documentation. So there's a real sense there which there any of the key black cultural figures or black political figures were being targeted by the ADL in a way which is really quite, I mean, you know, from this distance, clearly racist. But what's interesting about this document is that they say in there that they target extremists. And of course, if there are Jewish extremists, we will target them as well. But this whole document comes about as a result of the famous Crown Heights riot, which happened as a result of a Chabad rabbi jumping a red light and smashing into two young black kids, one of whom died, and that set off the riots. Yeah. And there's no sense in any of this that Chabad which, as we know from previous programs, is itself an extremist organization. And there's never been an occasion when the ADL has ever denounced extremist Jewish organizations. And that's partly because it is itself an extremist organization. Mm.
Well, Jared also responded to the claims about the ADL being useful to the FBI as part of its clandestine counterintelligence program known as COINTELPRO, much of which was actually illegal. Jared described some of the background to this mysterious program and explained how the ADL could have been useful to it.
Illegal once upon a time, but post 9/11 in the United States, most of everything that was done under the counterintelligence program is now perfectly legal. Making the whole discussion of legality almost moot. But the reality is, again, as I've been just trying to say, the ADL is designed in its own origin in politics and focus as, again, a Zionist, imperialist, pro-capitalist, white supremacist, settler colonial organization. It fits right in with what the politics and the goals of the broader state itself. And certainly the FBI has no problem in promoting those politics and ideas, whether among Jews, Arabs, Black Americans, Christians, whomever else. And that's exactly what they've done and will continue to do. So if the ADL presents itself as being willing to be used, in effect, to take advantage of the actual suffering of Jews historically and in real time, to become part of a very conservative and anti-human apparatus, well, then they'll be put to that use. And to that extent, that's exactly what the ADL has and continues to do, and why they will more than likely continue to find a happy home in allegiance with the FBI and other, again, members of that apparatus, more broadly speaking.
David, tell us about Al Sharpton, who was mentioned in the film there. He's a favoured voice, isn't he, of the ADL?
Yes, but he hasn't always been. And in this document we were just talking about a minute ago, he was one of the key people who was targeted by the ADL as being a black demagogue, an anti-Semite, who'd led what they called a pogrom against the Jews in Crown Heights and the Crown Heights riots. And, of course, now he's not. Now, so what happened? Well, what happened was that his organization was penetrated. And we saw in the film there the relationship with his producer, who's former Israeli intelligence. But really what we're seeing is part of a more general process whereby the Zionist organizations try to penetrate anti-racist organizations to bring them on side so that they won't criticize Israel, they won't stand up for Palestinian rights. And if they'll do that, then anything is fine.
Mm. Well, finally, we asked Jared what he made of Sharpton's TV show actually being produced by a former agent of Israeli intelligence.
On some level, I think it matters for sure, and I think it's something that is not to be ignored or set aside. But I think it's on some level even unnecessary to make note of, given the politics of Sharpton and his show. And Sharpton has made clear for a long time that he has been part of the rebranding of black radicalism as something that is supportive of black capitalism, liberal to conservative politics, et cetera. In other words, the rebranding of the actual revolutionary politics of a real life Dr. King as something that would be acceptable to mainstream American news and media, which is, to me, all the evidence we would need of the kind of politics that he is there to represent and has been there to represent. The added fact or note that you mentioned about his producer is, again, interesting and I think adds important context, perhaps, but ultimately isn't that important given the observable, demonstrable, performative politics that Sharpton has been and continues to represent.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time today. I hope you've found the program informative. Thanks to our guests, Professor Jared Ball, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
the limelight.
Although Palestinians had no official presence at the Qatar 2022 World Cup, the Palestinian flag was impossible to avoid, flown in the streets, waved in the stadiums, and draped on the shoulders of some of football's biggest stars. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International Roads, even before the World Cup kicked off in